Today, Robbie will begin to look at what Jesus Christ has to say in a message entitled, Christ's Answers for Man's Questions. Now, here's Robbie.
The approach that I would like to take this evening before I begin my defense of the Christian faith, because so much of this is done on a level that people have caricatures of Christianity, is I want to first start off by expressing to you how philosophy comes into your life and mine. When I'm talking about philosophy, therefore, I want to rescue it away from mere academia. I think C.S. Lewis is right. We all have a philosophy of life. The only question is whether it is a good one or a bad one. But we all live by certain maxims, certain what we would call principles to which our lives are fundamentally committed. I have lectured in the subject and it is one of my major fields of interest. So I like to at least give you a grid from which I operate so that you will understand what level I'm going to approach it at tonight. Philosophy comes at three levels. Level one is what I call the theoretical level. This is where the laws of logic and sound reasoning are brought to bear, where you unwrap an argument to see whether the statements being made correspond to reality, and when they are compiled into an argument, whether the syllogism is valid. So there are two tests at that point, not only the test of fact, but also the test of logical coherence. We cannot escape this. Philosophers have wrestled with this for centuries, and we deal with level one of theory. Philosophy, not everybody enjoys it, but when you get to the highest levels of disagreement, somewhere the weakness may be found in this level when it is opened up. The second is what I call level two, and this is the level of the arts. We find it much less vulnerable in our experience, both in East and West, to express what we really feel and believe in the arts. And sometimes we end up finding out that we find it easier to live in the arts than we find it easy to live in life itself. But the arts are second level of philosophy. The whole arena of imagination that is appealed to. And the movie industry is well aware of how potent an instrument that the arts really provide for you and for me. And this is where many, many questions are raised, and I will sustain this. I think it was the famed political activist from Scotland, Andrew Fletcher, who said, "Let me write the songs of a nation. I don't care who writes its laws." And Fletcher's belief was he could weave a consciousness into a mind if he's only given the leverage of music, he can control a whole generation. Maybe overstated, but certainly addressing the point of power there. And then there is level number three, which is what, for the want of a better term, I call it kitchen table conversation, day-to-day existence. It is where you work your thinking out. At that point, you don't always check back into level one. You don't make reference to level two, but it is the ideas by which you order your living. You don't seem to find it necessary. I don't seem to find it necessary to defend every decision we make at level three, but we need to be sure there is a connection to level one, which gives birth to how it is we ultimately live out our lives. Now, friends, I would love to go at all three levels tonight, but we'll be here for much longer than you would like to or I would like to. But I've dealt with this in some of my writings. In fact, in one of the books, I have dealt with some of the leading thinkers like Immanuel Kant, Soren Kierkegaard, Jean-Paul Sartre, and some of these who molded Western philosophy, whether it is in the analytical tradition or in the existential tradition. But I shall bypass that, and tonight I would like to deal at level two and level three, because if you remember, we dealt with the whole issue of social theory, how atheistic philosophy filtered into social theory, led to the process of secularization, which has bred a loss of a sense of shame, to the process of pluralization, which when it was extrapolated into relativism, inferred a relative loss of reason in the process, and privatization, which ended up with no meaning. So secularization with no shame, pluralization ending up with no reason, and privatization with no meaning. So we discussed existential struggles. I want to address those very existential struggles in the answers of Christ. How can we proceed? We can proceed in a very rigorous way. And I will just give you a brief moment to show you how it is I formulate my thinking as we give the answers here. I won't go into extensive description here, but when you take a test for truth, the last two are very tough to handle, so I won't belabor them. But very simply, we all operate on these three areas. We look for logical consistency. If there's something illogical that were presented to you in this argument, you're going to be sensitive to that, and you're going to say, Ravi, explain this to me, because you said this in the beginning, you said that in the end. It doesn't fit together. You'd have made a logical inference from what I would have said, and so you're looking for logical consistency. Empirical adequacy. Is there any way to test this? How do we know whether everything that Christ claimed really can be measured against concrete reality? Or was this just some messianic complex that he suffered from, as history is replete with examples of those who have come and gone? So there is logical consistency, empirical adequacy, and experiential relevance. Ultimately, you're going to say, so what? How does this work out in my life? Now, you may be well aware of how difficult a task this is. It can be a lifelong process, and all the more difficult in just one lecture, and I'll just give you a little grid as to why that is so. In the range of subjects that I'm going to cover tonight, just think of everything that is involved. There are at least five major disciplines we are pulling together into a composite whole. There are theological aspects, there are metaphysical aspects, there are epistemological aspects, meaning methods of how we arrive at truth. Morality and ethics is pulled in, and anthropology, who we are as human beings in our essence and in our behavior. So these five disciplines are brought together as we look at the whole arena of truth. And Jesus' claim, I am the way, said he, the truth and the life. No man comes unto the Father except through me. We assume, and I will be glad to defend it in the question and answer time, apart from all of the other sustaining philosophical and historical aspects that will be raised, let me debunk a common notion amongst radical liberal scholars, not liberals, radical liberal scholars like the Jesus Seminar or the Barbara Tierings and their theories, or Bishop Spong, who talk about the New Testament and the Bible as being untenable in its authority. Even liberal scholars don't go to that radical extent with some of their theories. Just compare the authenticity of the New Testament against several other historic works that we have, and look at the point of difference here. You take, for example, the works of Tacitus, where the date supposedly written was 100 AD. And the time lapse between the original writing and the earliest extant copy is 1,000 years beyond. And the number of copies that we have access to in bits and fragments is about 20. You take somebody like Demosthenes, again, you've got several centuries intervening between the original and the extant copies available and the numbers. You look at the New Testament, which was penned in the first century, and we've got earliest copies from the 7th century AD, and number of copies available are about 5,000. So much so that a man like Bruce Metzger of Princeton says that there is virtually no documentation that we have in existence of that degree of antiquity with such a high degree of certainty. Actually, Metzger places it at about 99.4%. And Simon Greenleaf, the famed professor of law at Harvard, made this comment. He said, you may choose at the end of your investigative process of the New Testament to say, I choose not to believe it, but you may not reserve the right to say, because there is not enough evidence to believe it. Now, this is the famed Simon Greenleaf, who is one of the most noted scholars in his time, and his writings are still used in several textbooks of law on evidentiary methods and so on. So we base it from a composite of several fields of study, but obviously my commitment in defense of Jesus's words are to the defense of the authenticity of the New Testament. With that, let me begin on the person of Christ and his answers. The famed historian Lecky made this comment about Jesus, and Lecky was not, as far as we know, a committed Christian. He was purely speaking as a historian here. The character of Jesus has not only been the highest pattern of virtue, but the strongest incentive in its practice, and has exerted so deep an influence that it may be truly said that the simple record of 3 short years of active life has done more to regenerate and to soften mankind than all the disquisitions of philosophers and all the exhortations of moralists. That is an incredible statement from a secular source. And it is one that, in a sense, makes Jesus the eternal contemporary. And our very calendar in that effect, for the most of the world, dated from that, the impact certainly of that life lived. One of the famed preachers, James Stewart of Scotland, put it with his own commitment to the Christian faith. And he said this about Jesus. He said he brings together in his being a startling coalescence of contrarieties. And then he goes on to explain, listen carefully, please. Obviously, he's coming from a preacher's and a theologian's viewpoint, but he says this. He says, in Jesus we see that he was the meekest and lowliest of all the sons of men, yet he spoke of coming on the clouds of heaven with the glory of God. He was so austere that they said evil spirits and demons cried out in terror at his coming. Yet he was so genial and winsome and approachable that the children loved to play with him and the little ones nestled in his arms. His presence at the innocent gaiety of a village wedding was like the presence of sunshine. No one was half so kind or compassionate to sinners, yet no one ever spoke such red-hot scorching words about sin. A bruised reed he would not break. His whole life was love. Yet on one occasion he demanded of the Pharisees how they were expected to escape the damnation of hell. He was a dreamer of dreams and a seer of visions. Yet for sheer stark realism, he has all of our self-styled realists soundly beaten. He was the servant of all, washing the disciples' feet. Yet masterfully he strode into the temple, and the hucksters and money changers fell over one another in their mad rush to get away from the fire they saw blazing in his eyes. He saved others, but at the last himself he did not save. There is nothing in history, says Stewart, like the union of contrasts which confronts us in the gospel. The mystery of Jesus, says he, is the mystery of divine personality. It's an incredible tribute from a sound theological mind. So whether you take the skeptic's view of Lecky, recognizing his impact, or you take the sympathetic view of a New Testament scholar and a theologian, you begin to see that the fact is he's made an enormous impact upon history. I have before me 7 different answers that he gives to the human condition. I don't know if I'll have time to go through all of them, but let me lay them out, especially in the order in which I have given to you. The first reason I trust the revelation and the teaching of Christ, apart from all the philosophical and historical aspects, is the accuracy of his description of the human condition. For centuries, we now have on hand his record that defines and describes what your heart is like and what my heart is like. It is the most accurate and the most exhaustive explanation of the human condition. In 1993, one of the most philosophically astute journalists I have ever read, I think his doctorate may be in philosophy, he writes in that quality of argumentation. I'm referring to Ron Rosenbaum, who writes in the weekend magazine of the New York Times. In 1993, he had a brilliant article calling it Long Island Babylon. And in that, he delineated the tragedies that Long Island had faced in its last 10 years. The hellish type of murders, slaughter of children, brutal crimes in households where men had savagely murdered their spouses or their children. And he said, I have begun to wonder what it is that's happening to us here in Long Island. And he gives a whole catalog of all that had happened. And he has an incredible way in which he ended that article. He said, sometimes I wish There could be an exorcism in my suburb, that all this dirt could be disgorged in some way so that we could be cleansed again and start with a clean slate. He said, but the moment I think of that, another metaphor comes to mind. The metaphor of the Islip barge in New York that was laden down with garbage several years ago, and nobody was going to allow them to dump it on their shores. And it went all along the Atlantic coast, went even to other parts than the United States, looking for a place to dump its dirt, and nobody would allow it. And Ron Rosenbaum ends his article by saying, maybe that barge is like a metaphor of what has happened to us here at Long Island. All this garbage, and we've got no place to empty it out. But he ends by saying this, for those of you who are reading this and tend to get amused by what's happening in Long Island, he said, beware, you may well be laughing at the face of your own onrushing future. That was 93. In 1995, I think towards the end of the year, he wrote a brilliant article entitling The Mystery of Wickedness. He said, now it is national. And here's the way he proceeded. He said, what is it about the Jeffrey Dahmers, the Menendez brothers, the Susan Smiths? And he listed a whole catalog of unthinkable crimes in our society. He said, I decided I wanted to find an answer. He phoned philosophers, he phoned politicians, he phoned ethicists, he phoned journalists. And finally, he said he began to get through in a simple conversation he had with Maury Povich, the talk show host. He said, I said, Maury, you're the one who listens to all these fellows who've done all these crimes. What is your explanation for it? He said, do you know what Maury Povich said to me? He said, I phoned him immediately after I saw a program of his where he was interviewing people who would commit murder for hire. And he said, Maury, what are your people responding to when they watch these programs? How are they responding? And he said, Maury Povich touched a nerve and gave me some insight that no other philosopher had given to me yet. He said, it was this. He said, Ron, two things happened on a program recently that jolted me and that I think has spelled a change in the American consciousness. These were the two incidents. He said, I can summarize it in a simple statement. When Eric Menendez reloaded, and Ron Rosenbaum says, I don't understand what you mean. He said, we had the description of the Menendez boys' murder of their parents on our television program, and they were listening to all kinds of psychological theories as to why they could have committed these dastardly crimes. Then all of a sudden, he said, something happened. After they had emptied their shotguns on their father and just murdered him mercilessly, the mother had a few bullets pumped into her but was still alive and was crawling across this bloodied floor, begging her sons not to kill her. She was literally pleading with Eric to stop the shooting. And as she lay there, half conscious and begging him to stop, he went outside, reloaded, came back, and emptied the rest of that canister into her body, killing her too. Maury Povich says, Ron, something happened at that moment to my audience. My producer said it was visible. It was like they threw their heads back and said, what does this mean? Where is the psychologist who's going to explain this? Somebody could have said, all right, all that happened in the childhood in the impulse of anger, you take such savage efforts for whatever reason. But when you go back in a cool, calm fashion and reload and come, and while your mother is pleading with you to stop, you finish her off. He says, Ron, something happened in that show. But as if that weren't enough, he said, the show continued that day, and we had people who knew the Jeffrey Dahmer saga had taken place, and psychologists who were trying to explain why Dahmer had murdered his victims and then cannibalized them. But then on the show, we had people who were selling Jeffrey Dahmer t-shirts and trinkets. And somebody in the audience stood up and said, what's their excuse? You know what Ron Rosenbaum said? Something has happened to us in America which says to me, our secular theories are not explaining what is the matter with us. We've got to dig deeper and take a look into the human heart. I don't know how many of you have done any reading of this, and I won't take time to read it because it's really an incredible statement, but it's long in order to give it to you in full force. But I remember when a few months ago, my colleagues and I were in Jerusalem doing some filming. And one of the areas we were doing some filming in was in the Holocaust Museum Yad Vashem. And as I went into the back room and we were trying to get some footage for a production we were doing ourselves, I saw several young people sitting in front of television screens watching the Eichmann trial. And I had read the transcripts of the Eichmann trial very thoroughly, and of course, as much as I could, because there's really thousands and thousands of pages, but I read them in certain compilations. And the most dramatic moment came, and maybe if I can read at least two paragraphs of it, you'll get the point here. Eichmann, before he went to the gallows, made this statement. Listen to Hannah Arendt's description of it. Adolf Eichmann went to the gallows with great dignity. He had asked for a bottle of red wine and had drunk half of it. He refused the help of the Protestant minister, the Reverend William Hull, who offered to read the Bible with him. He had only two more hours to live, and therefore he said, I've got, quote, no time to waste. He walked the 50 yards from his cell to the execution chamber, calm and erect, with his hands bound behind him. When the guards tied his ankles and knees, he asked them to loosen the bonds so that he could stand straight. I don't need that, he said, when the black hood was offered to him. He was in complete command of himself. Nay, he was more, he was completely himself. Nothing could have demonstrated this more convincingly than the grotesque silliness of his last words. He began by stating emphatically that he was a Gottgläubiger, to express in common Nazi fashion that he was no Christian and did not believe in life after death. He then proceeded, quote, after a short while, gentlemen, we shall all meet again. Such is the fate of all men. Long live Germany, long live Argentina, long live Austria. I shall not forget them, end of quote. In the face of death, he had found the cliché used in funeral oratory. Under the gallows, his memory played him the last trick. He was elated, and he forgot that this was his own funeral. It was as though in those last minutes, he was summing up the lesson that this long course in human wickedness had taught us. Listen to what Hannah Arendt says here. It was as though in these last moments, he was summing up the lesson that this long course in human wickedness has taught us, the lesson of the fearsome word and thought-defying banality of evil, the trivializing of evil. That is really what happens when you sloganeer your way through and do not know how to explain it. Jesus described the condition of the human heart as out of the heart issue all of the passions of life, all the way from deceit to crime and the ultimate criminalities that we witness. If you remember, we dealt with the whole issue of social theory, how atheistic philosophy filtered into social theory, led to the process of secularization, which has bred a loss of a sense of shame, to the process of pluralization, which when it was extrapolated into relativism, inferred a relative loss of reason in the process, and privatization, which ended up with no meaning. So secularization with no shame, pluralization ending up with no reason, and privatization with no meaning. So we discussed existential struggles. I want to address those very existential struggles in the answers of Christ. I have before me seven different answers that he gives to the human condition. The first reason I trust the revelation and the teaching of Christ, apart from all the philosophical and historical aspects, is the accuracy of his description of the human condition. For centuries, we now have on hand his record that defines and describes what your heart is like and what my heart is like. It is the most accurate and the most exhaustive explanation of the human condition. I remember when a few months ago, my colleagues and I were in Jerusalem doing some filming. And one of the areas we were doing some filming in was in the Holocaust Museum Yad Vashem. And as I went into the back room and we were trying to get some footage for a production we were doing ourselves, I saw several young people sitting in front of television screens watching the Eichmann trial. And I had read the transcripts of the Eichmann trial very thoroughly, and of course, as much as I could, because there's really thousands and thousands of pages, but I read them in certain compilations. And the most dramatic moment came, and maybe if I can read at least two paragraphs of it, you'll get the point here. Eichmann, before he went to the gallows, made this statement. Listen to Hannah Arendt's description of it. Adolf Eichmann went to the gallows with great dignity. He had asked for a bottle of red wine and had drunk half of it. He refused the help of the Protestant minister, the Reverend William Hull, who offered to read the Bible with him. He had only two more hours to live, and therefore he said, I've got, quote, no time to waste. He walked the 50 yards from his cell to the execution chamber, calm and erect, with his hands bound behind him. When the guards tied his ankles and knees, he asked them to loosen the bonds so that he could stand straight. "I don't need that," he said, when the black hood was offered to him. He was in complete command of himself. Nay, he was more. He was completely himself. Nothing could have demonstrated this more convincingly than the grotesque silliness of his last words. He began by stating emphatically that he was a Gottgläubiger, to express in common Nazi fashion that he was no Christian and did not believe in life after death. He then proceeded, quote, "After a short while, gentlemen, we shall all meet again. Such is the fate of all men. Long live Germany, long live Argentina, long live Austria. I shall not forget them," end of quote. In the face of death, he had found the cliche used in funeral oratory. Under the gallows, his memory played him the last trick. He was elated, and he forgot that this was his own funeral. It was as though in those last minutes, he was summing up the lesson that this long course in human wickedness had taught us. Listen to what Hannah Arendt says here. It was as though in these last moments, he was summing up the lesson that this long course in human wickedness has taught us, the lesson of the fearsome word and thought defying banality of evil, the trivializing of evil. That is really what happens when you sloganeer your way through and do not know how to explain it. Jesus described the condition of the human heart as out of the heart issue all of the passions of life, all the way from deceit to crime and the ultimate criminalities that we witness. How do we answer this from a secular viewpoint in contrast to what Christ said? Listen to the struggle that secular theorists now have. Viktor Frankl, who spent 2 times in Auschwitz, has a brilliant comment, and he made this statement about what we need to learn from this kind of evil. If we present man with a concept of man which is not true, we may well corrupt him. When we present him as an automaton of reflexes, as a mind machine, as a bundle of instincts, as a pawns of drives and reactions, as a mere product of heredity and environment. If we do that, we will feed the nihilism to which modern man is in any case prone. I became acquainted with the last stage of corruption in my second concentration camp, Auschwitz, says Frankl. The gas chambers of Auschwitz were the ultimate consequence of the theory that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or as the Nazis liked to say, of blood and soil. I am absolutely convinced, this is important now, folks, please listen. I am absolutely convinced, says Frankl, that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek were ultimately prepared not in some ministry or other of defense in Berlin, but rather at the desks and in the lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers. See what he's saying? He said, don't go to the military strategists to blame them as to what they did. He said there was a philosophy that was subsumed by them, that was taken on by them. He said it was not the Ministry of Defense that ultimately brought this kind of an interpretation, but there were nihilistic philosophers and theorists who were propounding an idea about humanity that ultimately denuded millions in the process and exacted so much suffering from humankind. So he points out how we define the essence of humanity determines what actions we will ultimately take. Now listen to an atheistic thinker, Herbert Maurer, who says more than I think he ever planned on saying on this subject. Herbert Maurer was a professor at Harvard. In 1954, was president of the American Psychological Association. In 1982, he committed suicide, unable to face life anymore on his own. But listen to what Herbert Maurer said in The American Psychologist. For several decades, we psychologists have looked upon the whole matter of sin and moral accountability as a great incubus, and we've acclaimed our liberation from it as epoch-making. But at length, we have discovered that to be free in this sense, to have the excuse of being sick rather than being sinful, is to also court the danger of becoming lost. This danger is, I believe, betokened by the widespread interest in existentialism which we are presently witnessing, in becoming amoral, ethically neutral, and free. We have cut the very roots of our being, lost our deepest sense of selfhood and identity, and with neurotics themselves find ourselves asking, who am I? What is my deepest destiny? What does living really mean? Jesus, in analyzing the human condition, wants you and me to first look at our own hearts. We may not do what an Eichmann did or the Menendezes did, but I think the point Christ makes is that the capacity for evil is locked into the human heart in that sense, and the tabula rasa, the blank slate that some philosophers would talk about, does not jive with reality. What jives with reality is that there is wickedness, and the mystery of wickedness will never be resolved until we can see our hearts as Christ has described them to be really so. But he did not stop merely at his description of my condition. He also made a provision for that malady. He made a provision for that malady. It is not merely in education and instruction. It is not merely in witnessing evil and growing up and in asking the question, but in recognizing the need individually and corporately as a society that the human heart needs to be transformed and find a higher moral law to which it can bend its knee. Shortly before Cambodia fell, I had had some meetings in two of those places. For 4 months I had been in Vietnam, traveling the length of the country, ministering particularly to the American soldiers there through their air bases and many other settings. And it was through their courtesy I had traveled through the country. It was their helicopter gunships that moved me from one city to another. And I watched the questions they were asking in that horrible time in the 60s. Shortly after that, I went on to Phnom Penh, just a few weeks before it was to fall. And late one night, my interpreter, who was not a Christian believer himself, but really searching and really hungry for answers, took me out to a play one night. And we walked alone. It was after curfew, and so we were having to find our way back. And I'll never forget, as we walked away from that play, I did not like the way it ended. The person who was doing the right thing in that was destroyed by some political power who was doing the wrong thing all the time. It was a good versus evil conflict, clearly, and done in marvelous Cambodian choreography. They are a gentle people. To see the dance and to see how well it was done with all of its color. When the end came, my heart just sank. And we were walking in that dark night, and I said to him, he said, "What did you think?" I said, "Beautiful cultural expression. I can simply identify with a lot of it. I see the touches of India in your culture." I said, "But you know, I have to tell you something. I didn't like the way the play ended." He said, "Why not?" I said, "There was something missing in that play." He said, "You're right." I said, "What do you think it was?" He said, "Do you know what was missing in that play, Mr. Zacharias?" He said, "Our country." And he choked. He wasn't that fluent in English, but he understood the terms. He said, "Our country desperately needs a savior. And we are looking for someone who can fight for the good and take away all this evil that is around us, with over 1 million people that have been slaughtered in our land." I said to him, "That's why I am in your country. It is not so much the country itself as much as the individual." And ladies and gentlemen, if you're honest enough to look at your own heart and look at what Christ said, that by our own education and by our own ability, we will only find more sophisticated ways to be self-centered and control each other with evil. He referred to it, in which has become a mocking point to secular theorists. He referred to it as a new birth because it was such a transformation that was brought in the human personality. I think of the famed poet Francis Thompson. Francis Thompson was a drug addict. He was an opium addict. Tried to get into Oxford University, I think 7 or 8 times, and they turned him down, not because he didn't have the mind, but because he was so hooked on his opium addiction. Francis Thompson used to wear a dirty raincoat and pick up newspapers from the dustbins of London. And he would walk through the area of the losers and the lost, which is Charing Cross. He would pick up newspapers and write letters to the editor, and the editors would say, a genius greater than Milton is among us, but we do not have a return address for him. He writes the most brilliant editorials, the most brilliant poetry, but we cannot get back to him. It was Thompson who was writing those. At night, he would go and lie by the River Thames with all of those who were also on that addiction, trying to cover himself with a raincoat amongst the homeless, as it were. and the daytime with at Charing Cross trying to find a way for his drug addiction, at nighttime sleeping by the River Thames. He picked up a Bible and he was reading it, and he read the story of Jacob. You remember how Jacob had been running from God after he lied and stole the blessing from his father. And while he was coming back and had to meet the brother whom he deprived of the blessing, he wrestles with God and he says, God, I won't let you go except you bless me. And God, in a tremendous maneuver with Jacob, says, what is your name? God asked him that question because years before, when he stole the blessing from Isaac, he lied about his name. He said, I'm Esau. And Isaac was blind. Isaac says, you don't sound like Esau. He said, I really am Esau. I need your blessing. And he stole the blessing. Now before he is to meet Esau face to face, he's wrestling with God in prayer. And he says, I'm not going to let you go except you bless me. And God says to him, what is your name? He says, my name is Jacob. He says, you've told the truth, Jacob, because you've admitted who you are. I will make a great nation out of you. And he changed Jacob's name. Francis Thompson was reading this. And then he wrote a brilliant masterpiece of a poem. O world invisible, we view thee. O world untangible, we touch thee. O world unknowable, we know thee. Inapprehensible, we clutch thee. Does a fish soar to find the ocean? An eagle plunge to find the air? Do we ask of the stars in motion if they have rumor of thee there? Not whether wheeling systems darken or our benumbed conceiving soars, the drift of pinions would we hearken, beats on our own clay shuttered doors. The angels keep their ancient places, touch but a stone and start a wing. Tis ye, tis your estranged faces that amiss the many splendored thing. But when so sad, thou canst not sadder cry, and upon thy so sore loss shall shine the traffic of Jacob's ladder pitched between heaven and Charing Cross. Yea, in the night, my soul, my daughter, cry clutching heaven by the hems. Lo, Christ walking on the water, not of Gennesaret, but Thames. That nearness that Christ brings in the transformation of the heart. I'm asked at least 100 times a year in some interview somewhere, what were you believing when you became a Christian? I could give you a long story other than to tell you that I was really an atheist. But I was lying on a bed of suicide when the Bible was brought to me. And for the first time, I couldn't even hold it in my hand because my body was dehydrated. I attempted to take my own life. And there, as my mother was reading out passages that she herself did not understand, but somebody had given to her, the transformation of heart took place. So you see, dear friend, it is not just the revelation of the sinfulness within. It is the provision for the malady that Christ also brings. Thirdly and quickly, he explains reality to me in the concepts that I think touch at the nerve of our present existential struggles. I want you to follow this because this is the only philosophical area I think we'll get into a little bit here. The fundamental search of philosophy has been summed up in the words, the searching for unity in diversity. In fact, on every American coin, you will see the words e pluribus unum. Out of the diversity, one. Out of plurality, one. The very word university means finding unity in diversity. Our whole academic pursuit was to find that which brought all of the disciplines together. We use the word, for example, quintessence. Where did we get that from? Because of the early Greek philosophers who said there were 4 unifying factors, earth, air, water, and fire. And somebody said those are the 4 essences. What is the 5th essence that unites these 4? What is the quintessence of life? So the search for philosophy has been unity and diversity. The search in our culture has been e pluribus unum. And we find that struggle even within the diversity of our passions in our lives. Can we find a unifying answer? I'll tell you this, the more I ponder on it, and I want you to understand because this is a sensitive area. As you know, I hail from India. My wife is from Canada. And therefore, in terms of reality, ours is a cross-cultural marriage. And the 3 children we have raised, therefore, are a product of a cross-cultural marriage. And I have taught my children, and they will say this to you. My daughter, my first oldest daughter, before she was 3, had covered 15 countries in the world traveling with us on every continent. And I have taught them to learn to find the splendor that is there in each of our cultures and the weaknesses that are there in each of the cultures. And the splendors are many. They are the richer because of their appreciation for the wealth of such a diversity that they have experienced. How sad it is then that at the fabric of this great country, maybe the pursuit of this country could be summarized in Julian Marias's words in the early early days of its formation to find the reconciliation of law with liberty amongst the diversity of people. To find the reconciliation of law with liberty amongst the diversity. I fondly believe with all of my heart the biblical answer addresses this more profoundly than anything I can say to you. Do you know why? It is this. When in the search for unity amongst diversity, in a search for community, when you look at the concept of the Trinity in the biblical teaching, where in the Trinity you see unity in diversity and community in the Trinity, it's a doctrine too mystifying, transcending the nature of a univocal understanding of the level of reality between the infinite and the finite. But it shows to me that there is a blending of oneness even where there may be a hierarchy of responsibility. And I think Professor Peter Kreft at Boston College has done a masterful job in delineating the distinction here. Follow me, please. The word egalitarianism and the word elitism. Egalitarianism means equality. Elitism means a hierarchy. And what Peter Kreft points out so incisively in the Christian belief system and in Christian teaching, there is to be an egalitarianism amongst us as human beings, but an elitism of ideas where all ideas are not equal. We have to understand which are superior, which are inferior, which are right and which are wrong. So there's an egalitarianism amongst people and an elitism in ideas. In postmodernism, do you know what has happened? They have made an egalitarianism of ideas and created an elitism of people, and in the process they have lost both truth and personal value. And postmodern thought has debunked the notion of truth, and in the process not only has it lost truth, it has lost personal value. You and I, the scriptures say, are created in the image of God. There is no greater value that anybody can give to you than that. And whether whichever part of the world we come from, that imago Dei, meaning by that, that moral consciousness and that self-determinism, in a sense, that moral consciousness that is given to us. So it is not only his explanation of condition and his provision for my malady, but he also gives an explanation of reality. So we find that unity in diversity because God has created us in his image, and we wrestle with each other not because of inequality. We wrestle to find out the ideas that may be superior or inferior, always respecting one another and not violating the sacred privilege that we have as individuals. And today I have friends all over this globe, many of them of different persuasion, but we can get off a plane and embrace one another, knowing that our struggle will be with ideas, not an intolerance of each other. But God has given to me through the scriptures this explanation of reality. How does it work out in my life? Yesterday a student asked this question of lust. How do you deal with lust in your own life? And Jesus gives the answer in worship. And in one of my books, I have given Archbishop William Temple's definition of it. Worship is the submission of all of our nature to God. It is the quickening of conscience by his holiness, nourishment of mind by his truth, purifying of imagination by his beauty, opening of the heart to his love, and submission of will to his purpose. And all this gathered up in adoration is the greatest expression of which we are capable. So the worship of God coalesces the diversity in my life inside, and the understanding of the created order by God in the Trinity itself gives to me the coalescing with my fellow human beings. His explanation of my condition, his provision for the malady, his explanation of reality. If you remember, we dealt with the whole issue of social theory, how atheistic philosophy filtered into social theory, led to the process of secularization, which has bred a loss of a sense of shame, to the process of pluralization, which when it was extrapolated into relativism, inferred a relative loss of reason in the process, and privatization, which ended up with no meaning. So secularization with no shame, pluralization ending up with no reason, and privatization with no meaning. So we discussed existential struggles. I want to address those very existential struggles in the answers of Christ. I have before me 7 different answers that he gives to the human condition. The first reason, I trust the revelation and the teaching of Christ. apart from all the philosophical and historical aspects, is the accuracy of his description of the human condition. For centuries, we now have on hand his record that defines and describes what your heart is like and what my heart is like. It is the most accurate and the most exhaustive explanation of the human condition. Jesus, in analyzing the human condition, wants you and me to first look at our own hearts. We may not do what an Eichmann did or the Menendezes did, but I think the point Christ makes is that the capacity for evil is locked into the human heart in that sense, and the tabula rasa, the blank slate that some philosophers would talk about, does not jive with reality. What jives with reality is that there is wickedness, and the mystery of wickedness will never be resolved until we can see our hearts as Christ has described them to be really so. But he did not stop merely at his description of my condition. He also made a provision for that malady. He made a provision for that malady. It is not merely in education and instruction. It is not merely in witnessing evil and growing up and in asking the question, but in recognizing the need individually and corporately as a society that the human heart needs to be transformed and find a higher moral law to which it can bend its knee. Thirdly and quickly, he explains reality to me in the concepts that I think touch at the nerve of our present existential struggles. I want you to follow this because this is the only philosophical area I think we'll get into a little bit here. The fundamental search of philosophy has been summed up in the words, the searching for unity in diversity. In fact, on every American coin, you will see the words e pluribus unum. Out of the diversity, one. Out of plurality, one. The very word university means finding unity in diversity. Our whole academic pursuit was to find that which brought all of the disciplines together. We use the word, for example, quintessence. Where did we get that from? Because of the early Greek philosophers who said there were four unifying factors, earth, air, water, and fire. And somebody said those are the four essences. What is the fifth essence that unites these four? What is the quintessence of life? So the search for philosophy has been unity and diversity. The search in our culture has been e pluribus unum. And we find that struggle even within the diversity of our passions in our lives. Can we find a unifying answer? You and I, the scriptures say, are created in the image of God. There is no greater value that anybody can give to you than that. And whichever part of the world we come from, that imago Dei, meaning by that moral consciousness and that self-determinism, in a sense, that moral consciousness that is given to us. So it is not only his explanation of condition and his provision for my malady, but he also gives an explanation of reality. So we find that unity in diversity because God has created us in his image, and we wrestle with each other not because of inequality. We wrestle to find out the ideas that may be superior or inferior, always respecting one another and not violating the sacred privilege that we have as individuals. And today I have friends all over this globe, many of them of different persuasion, but we can get off a plane and embrace one another, knowing that our struggle will be with ideas, not an intolerance of each other. But God has given to me through the scriptures this explanation of reality. How does it work out in my life? Yesterday, a student asked this question on lust. How do you deal with lust in your own life? And Jesus gives the answer in worship. And in one of my books, I have given Archbishop William Temple's definition of it. Worship is the submission of all of our nature to God. It is the quickening of conscience by his holiness, nourishment of mind by his truth, purifying of imagination by his beauty, opening of the heart to his love, and submission of will to his purpose. And all this gathered up in adoration is the greatest expression of which we are capable. So the worship of God coalesces the diversity in my life inside, and the understanding of the created order by God in the Trinity itself gives to me the coalescing with my fellow human beings. His explanation of my condition, his provision for the malady, his explanation of reality. Fourthly and quickly, his transcendence over history. Have you noticed how specific the Bible writers are? And this is so important. The Bible says about Jesus in the Old Testament, it says, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. It does not say the son is born. It does not say that it says the son is given. It is the child that is born. The son eternally existed. You see, the existentialist lives for the moment. The utopianist lives for the future. The traditionalist lives for the past. The traditionalist lives for the past. The existentialist for the moment. The utopianist for the future. Jesus, when he took the bread and broke it with his disciples, he said, as oft as you eat of this bread and drink of this cup, now you do proclaim the Lord's death in the past until he come in the future. He fused every moment of history with meaning. The eternal contemporary, as Lecky in those words has pointed out. The scriptures make it so clear. Let me give you this example. And liberal scholars were bothered by this for years. They did not know how to handle it. In Daniel chapter 8, and Daniel was written in the mid-500s before Christ. In Daniel chapter 8, he talks about this. He said, there will emerge a he-goat from the west. He will be strong and decimating of all that comes in his path. But that he-goat will be suddenly cut down, and his kingdom will be divided into four. Those four then will merge into two and ultimately emerge into one. Daniel wrote this in the mid-500s before Christ. And no commentator then could have understood what he was talking about. Now you read those chapters 8 onwards, you see what he was talking about. He talked about the emergence of Alexander the Great, that he-goat from the west, destructive in his path, and that he would be suddenly cut off as he was in his 20s, and his kingdom was divided into four. Then you take those four, they were blended into two, the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid, and that emerged into the Roman Empire. This was 200 years before the actualizing of the events. It became so troublesome that critical scholars did not know how to handle it. And so bringing a prejudice against the supernatural said this could not have been prophetic. This was post-written history. But now as more has been unearthed from the Dead Sea Scrolls and so on, and the linguistic analysis shows itself to be when it really was, now they're trying to find some other names. In fact, I was just watching a debate by a scholar from Columbus, Ohio, who the atheists put as their sort of their monster destroyer, take him on. When I was doing open forums at Ohio State University, and I'll never forget what our host said. He said, I think we're going to have to call upon Zindler to deal with these men. Zindler can chew up anybody. He's an atheist. William Lane Craig debated as Zindler, the cream of the crop of the atheists, they said. There were 7,000 watching this debate. Over 600 of them were non-Christians who voted at the end. And they gave him, I think, a 97 or a 98% victory to the theist over against the atheist. That's included in the uncommitted audience or those who came as non-Christians. But I'm just pointing it out to alert to you that these philosophers now, and I was listening to Zindler, and Zindler now does not know what to do with the book of Daniel. So he says, well, the book of Daniel got the last king in the last chapter, got the name wrong. First, they were trying to tell us it was post-written history. Now, when that has been debunked, they're telling us that he got the names wrong, even though he was supposedly writing after the fact. And the fact is that is completely incorrect. The monarch that was named by Daniel was co-regent along with Nabonidus. And all I'm saying to you is history was important in the prophetic scheme and has withstood the test of time. His transcendence over history. Fifthly and quickly, his equipment in suffering. I shall just leave that and move on because the last two points are important here, and then I shall leave it open for questions. Number sixth is his triumph over death. So his explanation of my condition, his provision for my malady, his explanation of reality, his transcendence over history, his equipment in suffering. Sixthly, his triumph over death. Jesus prophesied his own resurrection. And the Apostle Paul said about the resurrection, if Jesus was not raised from the dead, then our entire belief is in vain and we are yet in our sins. So said the Apostle Paul, that on the resurrection he hung the coat of his own conversion. And you know, it is an incredible thing how many theories have come to try to explain away the resurrection. If you really want to read the mind's manufacturing ability for mythology, read those who try to explain this away. You'll be more humored by it than anything else. They've tried for years. You know, the swoon theory, that he actually fainted, didn't really die. The disciples stole the body. And then, of course, 11 out of the 12 of them went to die a martyr's death for having stolen the body and Belen pretending that he'd actually risen. All of these theories become so hard to explain because they're not willing to deal with the text as it really is. And it is this. Have you ever thought for a moment that if the disciples wanted an easy way out, they could have come up with this theory of the resurrection? Yes, I know he died. Yes, I know you put him behind inside a tomb, but he told us he would spiritually rise again. And that's all we needed to believe, that he spiritually rose again. They went the hard route. They didn't say he spiritually rose again. They said he bodily rose again, which means they put themselves in a very vulnerable position. You know what that position was? All that had to be brought about to completely destroy Christianity was to present the body of Christ. And the Roman authorities and the temple authorities would have loved to have done it. But that resurrection, which transformed the people at that time, made an enormous impact, and history records that as the transforming moment for the early church. Billy Graham tells the story when he was a young evangelist. He was invited to visit Konrad Adenauer, in one time mayor of Cologne and then became the chancellor after Hitler. And Billy Graham said he was very nervous when Konrad Adenauer had called him into his chancellor's chambers. And he said, I was sitting there nervously in his room, and I watched Adenauer walk over to the window and look at all of the debris that was in his city, all the ravages of the bombing. And he said he was looking out of the window, and then he turned to me and he said, Mr. Graham, do you really believe Jesus rose from the dead? Billy Graham said, it was such a simple question and it was such a shocking one. I said, Mr. Adenauer, if I did not believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I would have no reason to preach the gospel. I would have no gospel left to preach. He said, Adenauer looked at me, walked back to the window, looked out again, and he said, Mr. Graham, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. He'd seen sin in its horror and what it had done to his people and to the world, and he recognized that if Jesus really rose from the dead, that would be the answer upon which any hope could stand. And isn't it true? We long for it within, don't we? C.S. Lewis has a beautiful way to illustrate this hunger. He said, we talk about our universal experiences with surprise. And he says, why is that? We look at somebody and say, my, how you've grown. Or we say, my, how time flies. He said, that would be as strange as a fish complaining how wet the water is. He says, unless, of course, it was meant to live on dry land. And this hunger for the eternal, this hunger and this hope that we long for. Hardy Shaul, a U.S. soldier in Vietnam, wrote these words, Lord God, I have never spoken to you, but now I want to say, how do you do? You see, God, they told me you didn't exist, and like a fool, I believed all this. Last night from a shell hole, I saw your sky. I figured right then they had told me a lie. Had I taken time to see the things you made, I'd have known they weren't calling a spade a spade. I wonder, God, if you'll take my hand. Somehow I feel that you'll understand. Funny I had to come to this hellish place before I had time to see your face. Well, I guess there isn't much more to say, but I'm sure glad, God, I met you today. I guess 0 hour will soon be here, but I'm not afraid since I know you're near. The signal, well, God, I'll have to go. I like you lots. I want you to know. Look now, this will be a horrible fight. Who knows, I may come to your house tonight. Though I wasn't friendly to you before, I wonder, God, if you'd wait at your door. Look, I'm crying. I'm shedding tears. I'll have to go now, God. Goodbye. Strange now since I met you. I'm not afraid to die. The hope that Christ gives. I summarize it for you and mention my last one, illustrate it, and we'll be through. Jesus, his description of my condition, his provision for my malady, his explanation of reality, his transcendence over history, his equipment in suffering, his triumph over death, and last but not the least, his embodiment of every ideal that every culture had ever pursued. His embodiment of every ideal that every culture had ever pursued. For you see, that which symbolized the pursuit of the Hebrews was light. The Lord is my light and my salvation. This is the light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. The pursuit of the Greeks was symbolized by knowledge, that we might know. And you see that that pursuit of light in the Hebrews, knowledge in the Greeks, and the pursuit of the Romans was glory, the glory of the Roman Empire. Light, the ideal of the Hebrews. Knowledge, the ideal of the Greeks. Glory, the ideal of the Romans. And the Apostle Paul, who was a Hebrew by birth, raised in a Greek city and a citizen of Rome, says this to the church at Corinth: God, who commanded his light to shine out of darkness, has caused his light to shine into our hearts, to give to us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ Jesus, our Lord. Jesus embodied the ideal. His was not just theoretical answers. It was the embodiment of every virtue and every ideal. God, who caused the light to shine out of darkness, has caused his light to shine in our hearts, to give to us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ Jesus, our Lord. His life, you study his life, and you find that nearness that he brings transforms you so magnificently that after all of the answers and all of the explanations can be given, the most precious realization comes when you can know him in that personal way. Look at one slight counter-apologetic, which actually also becomes an answer. It is so marvelous when the disciples looked at him and said, "At what hour are you going to return?" And Jesus said, "Of that hour no man knows, not even the Son of Man." Think of the humility in the life of that begottenness, as it were, his humanity then. Had he been a charlatan, he could have had his way by saying, "I know that hour, but I'm not going to tell you that hour. You just keep waiting at that moment, it'll happen." But in his simplicity, he says, "Of that hour no man knows, not even the Son of Man." The honesty and the pristine life that he had lived, it took him all the way ultimately to the cross as he cried out for them. And he said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing." The cross he offers for forgiveness, the empty tomb he offers for hope and the resurrection. And you bring all of this composite together, and I think of the brilliant words of that possibly the most brilliant journalist of the 20th century, English journalist in the 20th century, Malcolm Muggeridge, who was such an atheist, had such a mocking pen, ridiculed everything that was sacred, till the day came that Muggeridge himself bent his knee to Christ and wrote that book, Jesus Rediscovered. I had the privilege of spending some time with him and touching his heart, as it were, on what led to his own conversion. He'd seen enough mediocrity in this world. He'd seen enough hollow demagogues in this world. He'd seen all of the hell and the evil around. And he bent his knee ultimately to the purifying power of Christ. And he made these comments in his book, The End of Christendom, when he was delivering a series of lectures at the University of Waterloo, now Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada. And he said this: "We look back upon history, and what do we see? Empires rising and falling, revolutions and counter-revolutions, wealth accumulated and wealth dispersed. Shakespeare has spoken of the rise and fall of great ones that ebb and flow with the moon. I look back upon my own fellow countrymen, once upon a time dominating a quarter of the world, most of them convinced in the words of what is still a popular song, that the God who made them mighty shall make them mightier yet. I've heard a crazed, cracked Austrian announce to the world the establishment of a Reich that would last 1,000 years. I've seen an Italian clown saying he was going to stop and restart the calendar with his own ascension to power. I've met a murderous Georgian brigand in the Kremlin, acclaimed by the intellectual elite of the world as a wiser than Solomon, more humane than Marcus Aurelius, more enlightened than Ashoka. All in one lifetime, all in one lifetime, all gone, gone with the wind. England, part of a tiny island off the coast of Europe, threatened with dismemberment and even bankruptcy. Hitler and Mussolini dead, remembered only in infamy. Stalin, a forbidden name in the regime he helped found and dominate for some 3 decades. America haunted by fears of running out of those precious fluids that keep some motorways roaring and the smog settling, with troubled memories of a disastrous campaign in Vietnam and the victory of the Don Quixotes of the media as they charged the windmills of Watergate. All in one lifetime, all gone. He says, behind the debris of these solemn supermen and self-styled imperial diplomatists stands the gigantic figure of one person, because of whom, by whom, in whom and through whom alone mankind may still have peace, the person of Jesus Christ. I present him to you as the way, the truth, and the life, who not only understands your heart, but transcends history, conquered the grave, and provides the corrective for the heart that is so wrong, that we may live with the unity in the diversity that God alone can give to us.
Does it really matter what a person believes in? Does it matter what a person thinks about Jesus Christ? Jesus claimed to be the only way to God, the only way to have a new and clean heart. Whatever a person decides about Jesus, it's clear that his message must be honestly investigated. Ravi stated several of the key reasons why he believes that the gospel is reliable, including Jesus' resurrection and his fulfillment of prophecy.